Some years ago, I was reading an article about polls and surveys. And, you know, you're always finding out hearing polls and surveys on the news and things like that. What they discovered, which isn't very surprising in a way, was that they couldn't really make sense. The information they got when they asked people about political parties or political leaders or things like that often didn't tally with what happened when people voted. Yeah? People didn't sort of follow through on their ideas about things like that. They actually found that they got much better information about people's likely responses if they asked questions about that were more symbolic, more representational. And I'll give you some examples. Because this evening, and this will explain that, this evening we're going to look at animals. We're going to be talking about animals. So what sort of animal is Tony Blair?
Sheep.
Any other ideas?
A wolf in sheep's clothing.
Ah. Any other ideas? It's not, you know, be as off the wall as you like.
A tortoise.
A tortoise. And a particular reason for that? Or it doesn't really matter.
You know, it's challenged, so it doesn't really respond. It's kind of
just goes back in, right.
And a mouse.
A mouse.
It's been described as a poodle, isn't it?
That's right, yeah. Steve Bellbism was a poodle, isn't he? All right, well, in that case, Mr. Bush. What sort of animal is Mr. Bush?
A parrot.
A parrot?
A slug.
I mean, I think when we were talking about this at the dinner table at home, and I was sort of saying, I thought he was probably some sort of not very bright bear. I get the impression he's large and slightly dangerous and not very bright. I sincerely hope so. I really, really hope you can't become the president of America. Anybody got any idea what sort of animal Michael Howard is?
Fox.
Yeah, he seems a bit kind of... a bit Weasley, doesn't he? Ian Duncan Smith, what sort of animal was he?
A sloth.
What about the Queen? What sort of animal is the Queen?
A poodle.
A poodle? Not a corgi, then.
A sausage dog
with your German ancestry. What about David Blaine? I mean, but maybe this isn't a great example of it, but what they found out is it gave them a much greater sense of... They got a lot more usable information, curiously enough. No information that wasn't quantified. If you ask what sort of car the leader of a political party is, as it were, or a contender for something is, people give you a much stronger... You get a much stronger sense of who they're... of what they feel about that person than if you ask them whether they'll vote for them or not. Interesting stuff, I thought. So, what kind of animals are you? What kind of animal are you at your best? A domestic cat or a sort of lynx, or sort of one of those sorts of... A really fluffy, cuddly, really fluffy, cuddly one. That sort of cat.
A human animal.
What about at your worst? I mean, it might be that there are different aspects of oneself. I suppose when I was thinking about this for myself, I could think, well, actually, there's kind of like there's a kind of... I can do the irritating Labrador puppy thing sometimes, you know, like. Sort of thing, but I can also do kind of I suppose the armadillo thing. The armadillo is that kind of slightly armoured, defensive kind of thing as well. They've both got positive and negative aspects. Yeah, I think that's a very good point, actually, in terms of our failings. This is a key sort of little thing I like. I think we have certain predilections, as it were, certain tendencies in how we are. And when we express those tendencies with awareness and with creativity, then they are strengths. When we express those tendencies with insufficient awareness and with kind of a, what you might say, in a reactive sense, then those are our failings as well. They're the same tendencies, I think. So the issue, I think what's useful about that is the issue is one can always work to cultivate greater awareness. One can always work to cultivate greater creativity in a situation, yeah? In a way that one can't, in a way that kind of sort of saying, oh, I've got this failing, kind of, you sort of trap yourself in a corner with that, if you relate to yourself in that way. Yeah? If you relate to yourself on the basis of your weaknesses, as it were. What do you do with that? You can always cultivate more awareness. You can always try and be a little bit more creative. Slight aside, but I think Karen's point's a good one in a way. It's kind of like, in a way, we're probably the same animal at our best and our worst. Yeah, there's the kind of, sometimes it feels like a cranky old version of said animal, doesn't it? Anyway, the reason I'm kind of kicking around this animal stuff is that smack bang in the middle of the wheel of life, we've got this sort of hub thing. Anybody who wants to see one, see one? There's a few more here. Yeah, you two can. And what? He's got one tattooed on his arm. Anybody else want? Most people have got access to one. Good, I can look them on. So, in the middle we've got three animals. And they're a pig, a snake and a cock. And on this particular occasion what's happening is each of them is biting the other's tail. Sometimes it's as though they're both coming out of the mouth of the pig. The snake and the cockerel are coming out of the mouth of the pig rather than the other way around. And this being the wheel of life, this is not an expression of us at our best, at our finest. Yeah? These three animals represent what's sometimes called the three unwholesome roots, sometimes called the three mental poisons. But these are the kind of, what you could say is the negative drives, our negative drives. These are the negative powers which turn the wheel of samsara. Yeah, the wheel of conditioned existence goes round and round and round and round, powered by these three basic unwholesome volitions. They're not our only volitions, but they're the kind of root of the unwholesome side of our motivations. And as such, we need to pay attention to us. Now the way that Sangharakshita, who's the chap who's founded the movement of which this centre's part, founded the order of which I'm a member, he gives a talk about the Wheel of Life in which he talks about it as a series of mirrors, in a way. And he talks very starkly about this. He sort of says, you know, we talk about these animals as kind of representing unwholesome qualities, but actually we need to be a bit more challenging with ourselves and imagine ourselves looking in a mirror. And we look in a mirror, and instead of our usual face looking at it, we see a pig. You know? We see a pig looking back at us. Sometimes we look in the mirror and we see this snake's head hissing at us. And sometimes we look out and we see this chicken, hen, thing, cockerel desperately pecking around, pecking around. So the pig symbolizes ignorance. And I suppose there's a connection with that. Although we can tend to associate pigs with greed in the West. There is this phrase, pig ignorant, isn't there, in English. So it's kind of, it's not absolutely alien to us. The snake, in a way the snake's quite understandable, isn't it? It's a snake as an expression of ill will or anger, hatred. That's kind of quite sort of pantomime, isn't it? That sort of we're familiar with the snake as a kind of an expression of nasties. And then the cockerel in this case represents greed, because if you look at chickens, they're always pecking around looking for food, always on the go looking for food, looking for more, pecking around the dirt. So as I was saying, sometimes they each bite each other's tail. They're kind of feeding each other in a circle, as it were. They're kind of driving each other. Or sometimes it's as though hatred and greed are an expression or a consequence of ignorance. Yeah. They come out, and it's kind of like sometimes it looks as though the pig's biting their tails in a way, but it's more like they're coming out of the pig's mouth, I think. Or at least that's how I understand it. So the obvious question that comes out of that is, well, what is the nature of this ignorance? Of what are we ignorant? Is that a reasonable question?
Yes, no, no, darling.
Give me my elastic band back so I can fire it at you again. Well, what we're ignorant of, or ignorant about, is our own true nature. Yeah? We're ignorant about who or what we really are. We think there's something substantial, permanent, behind our experience. Yeah? Some of you have run through this with before, but it's always worth remembering, largely because we just forget all the time. What time is it? Yeah, let's do that. So close your eyes. Look inside, as it were, and see if you can find who it is who's having your experience. Where is the experiencer? So you can feel bodily sensations. You might be able to feel emotions. You might have thoughts or ideas going through your mind. And what we do, quite reasonably in a way, quite understandably, is we assume that there's a something that has, or a someone, there's a me, as it were, a persisting me, that has these experiences, that feels these feelings, that has these thoughts. Now, according to the Buddhist tradition, the reason you can't find that experiencer is because it's made up. We are simply our experiences. And there's nothing behind those experiences having the experience. Now there's a curious business that comes out of all this. Is that I suspect on some level we're aware of this insubstantiality of the self, because it seems to be extremely fragile in a way, very vulnerable. We seem to need to protect or defend it, to reinforce our sense of self continually, habitually, and often quite violently. Yeah? So if someone challenges how we see things, disagrees with our interpretation of things. It's a big deal, isn't it? It's no small thing when somebody sees things in a very different way to you. When somebody holds different views to you. So I wonder if there's a way in which we know that this is made up, this sense of self. And so what we do, the way we defend it, the way we create this sort of sense of self, is we tell ourselves stories. We have a story about who we are. And it's a pretty complex story, and we're constantly reinforcing it. We keep telling us, I'm like this. This is what I'm like. I'm the kind of person who likes Ian Duncan Smith, but doesn't like Michael Howard, you know. I'm the kind of person who likes this football club, but not that football club. Who is interested in football, but not whatever. I like these foods. I don't like those foods. I'm prepared to wear these brands of clothing, but not those brands of clothing. Yeah, I have these particular sexual tastes. I have this particular partner. I'm of this nationality, this race, this gender. We've got all these stories about who we are that we tell ourselves all the time. Now what happens is that from time to time, reality and our stories come into contact with each other. And reality comes into contact with this story about who we are, about what the world's like, in a way that doesn't accord with our story, or in a way that does accord with our story. Yeah. So if we come across something that accords with our story about who we are, what our world's like, how things are, then we want to acquire it. We want to include it in our sense of how things are. We want to appropriate it. Yeah? We want to include, grab it in. And this is the basic tendency of greed. Yeah, this basic tendency to sort of want to add things on to the ego, as it were. Whether it be more power, more prestige, a more attractive lover, a newer, faster motor car, whatever it is, more cuddly armadillos. And at times, life doesn't agree with our story of who we are. And when that happens, our sense of who we are is very strongly threatened, and we push it away. So we react with aversion. We react with hatred. So the loony on the bus, or somebody with very differing political views to us, or food we don't like or something. We want to push it out. We want to protect ourselves, protect our sense of who we are, by excluding this threat. And we thereby just reinforce the story, as it were. This is kind of how ignorance expresses itself. This mistaken way of relating to ourselves, relating to the world, expresses itself in this continual cycle of grasping and pushing away, grasping and pushing away. Yeah? We relate to everything that we come across in terms of whether it supports our view of who we are and how the world is, or whether it threatens it. Yeah? So we grasp, we push away, we grasp, we push away, thereby reinforcing that view, yeah? Thereby turning the wheel. Now, I'll just say a little bit more, and then maybe we could do some group chatty stuff, group discussion-y stuff. We all are, to some degree, ignorant. We're all ignorant of this nature ourselves. We all experience aversion. We all experience hatred. We often don't like to accept that that's the case, but it's the truth. We all experience greed, craving, grasping. But we can tend to have, you may notice that you might notice that you do more of one than the other. So for those of us who, in our experience, assume we all have roughly similar experience, yeah? Some of us pay more attention to the stuff in our experience that we like, yeah? The stuff that we want to add to our sense of ourselves. And so we manifest, so we're what Buddhism calls greed types. Yeah? You can tell greed types, they tend to be a bit portly, often. They also tend to be, it ties into this whole thing, you know, this sort of traditional thing about, chubby, cheerful people. You know, there's a kind of, they often relate to that they, what happens is, within the field of experience, assume you've got roughly 50-50 experience, as it were, some of us pay more attention to the stuff we like, and so we have a nicer time. Yeah? That kind of makes your life a bit more pleasant. It makes practicing spiritual life a bit harder in certain respects, but it... Otherwise. Some people pay more attention to the things that they don't like. Yeah? In the jargon of neuro-linguistic programming, in psychological jargon, what they do is they process away from. Yeah. So some of us process towards. Some of us notice what we like and we move towards it. Some of us notice what we don't like and we move away from it. Yeah. Buddhism calls those people hate types. They're often very thin. They often have metro driver's mouth. Are you familiar with metro driver's mouth?
No.
You know, that sort of going through life with that sort of...
I
don't know, there's something about metro drivers often used to have that sort of mouth. I don't quite know. No? You're not familiar with this phenomenon? Oh well, maybe I just made it up. It's not a key part of Buddhist doctrine, actually. Metro driver's mouth. I confess it's not. No, it's not quite the same as that. Then you've got delusion types. Delusion types have a lot of trouble deciding whether they like things or not, really. Because there's a kind of... Basically, when we have an experience, it's either pleasant or painful or it's neutral. It sort of falls into that middle zone. Delusion types often can't quite make their mind up. So they're often very messy, disorganized people. Just one of some very basic sort of Buddhist character analysis. One can find it useful. I could find it useless, actually, but I just thought I'd mention it. There's anything else I want to say about that? I suppose this is an early Buddhist teaching. Yeah? This comes from what's called early Buddhism in certain respects. So it's looking... It does look at the human condition in terms of processing away from, actually. It's actually, because the early Buddhist teaching is very much about seeing the unsatisfactoriness of life and moving away from that. Yeah, the whole model of renunciation is very big in early Buddhism. So there's quite a lot of emphasis on kind of the darker side. In later Buddhism, that's why we're looking at our failings, in a way. That's why at the sort of centre of this wheel, as it were, there's our weaknesses, craving, hatred, and ignorance, delusion. I was trying to think of animals that represented the opposite of these qualities. I mean, maybe you can think of that. And it occurred to me that Buddhism doesn't do that. What happened later on in Buddhism is that Buddhism developed figures who represented the opposites of these qualities. Yeah? So you can see around the place we've got these Buddha and Bodhisattva figures. I've probably made reference to them before. And there's a whole bunch of them over there above Jackie's head. One thing called the refuge tree. And what happens in a few years after the Buddha's death is that different Buddhist figures develop to represent the positive qualities, as it were. For those of us who like to move towards something, as it were, we need to have something to move towards other than just abstract ideals. And so those human qualities perfected become embodied in Buddha and Bodhisattva figures. So it's interesting that Paul's a big fan of this figure Ratnasambhava, which he's made this rather yellow and Ratnasambhava-y shrine behind me. So Ratnasambhava is the opposite of the cock, in a way. Ratnasambhava is generosity incarnate, is abundance incarnate. I mentioned last week that yellow was associated with abundance, didn't I? I did, actually. You might not remember it, but I did. And so Ratnasambhava is a yellow Buddha. The most obvious one's the picture behind his head. And he's represented in this gesture of absolute generosity. It's called Varada Mudra. So it's a key point in Buddhism, which I think is worth coming back to again and again and again, that what we say, how we act, is always an expression of what's going on in our minds. Yeah? Mind precedes all things. Yeah? So the mental state you're in will be expressed by how you communicate, how you hold yourself, what you do. Yeah? So each of these Buddhist figures has a particular posture which represents a state of mind, which is a communication of a state of mind. So this, understandably, is a representation of generosity. It's worth trying out, actually. It's worth having a go. I was on a weekend on a figure which has this mudra, and there was a woman who led a little mudra workshop, and it was great, actually. So try putting your hand out like that. And then just notice, and you might take a few moments. Notice how that feels different to putting your fingers on the ground with your palm down. Notice how it feels different to having your hand clenched, your fist clenched, either inwards or outwards. And then open it up again. It's quite subtle, but it does feel different, doesn't it? Mm. And this is a universal sort of, you know, language of giving, isn't it? That's kind of this guy Nick's doing British sign language at the moment. I remember the bit of sign language I did, you know, that is about giving. It's a fairly standard thing.
My hand's still
there. No, you've got anything,
you know.
Give me the elastic hand. So Ratnasambhava means the jewel bearing or the jewel born. So he's kind of about riches. He's about a sense of inner abundance out of which you can communicate. Yeah, most of us have a sense of inner poverty a lot of the time. We're always looking outwards for something that we can fill whole with, as it were. Yeah, Ratnasambhava embodies that sense of just being able to give, being fully resourced, absolutely fully resourced. There's a number of different ways you can look at the opposite of the snake, the opposite of hatred. Hatred finds its expression in the desire to cause harm. Yeah? So the opposite of hatred is love, in a way. But love also finds its expression in Buddhism. Love is generally talked about in terms of being expressed through compassion, actually. Yeah? The idea being that if you're in a loving state of mind and you come into contact with somebody who's not doing very well, who's suffering in any way, then your response to their suffering is of compassion, is of wishing to be kind to them. Yeah? And there are a number of different figures that represent compassion. The one that occurred to me as perhaps the most accessible in a way is a figure called Green Tara. So this is a female figure who's green. Green is the colour, I think, again, I mentioned last week, the colour of action. And she also has this mudra of generosity in one hand. The other hand is in a gesture of bestowing blessings. Kind of a... And she, the reason I mention her is this action figure. Most Buddhist figures, as I'm sure you're familiar, sit in this cross-legged posture. I mentioned this last week, didn't I? Green Tara has one leg extending. She's kind of stepping out to help people. Yeah? She's expressing her compassion through moving towards helping. The opposite of the pig is the Bodhisattva of Wisdom, Manjushri. Interestingly, wisdom, the embodiment of wisdom is called the gentle-voiced one. That's interesting, isn't it? I don't know what it means, but it's mysterious. It's not quite what you expect of wisdom, is it, for it to be gently voiced? He's a Bodhisattva, so he's a... Bodhisattvas tend to be depicted as sort of in the prime of life. According to the traditional Indian symbolism, that's kind of 16. I don't think of 16-year-olds as being in prime of life. I think of them as being deeply irksome. So I tend to think of them as being sort of early 20s or something like that. They're always very beautiful. So Manjushri is depicted as a crown prince, and he's sort of amber-coloured. If you imagine light through amber. And he holds a text representing wisdom, sometimes to his heart, sometimes on a lotus. And he holds the flaming sword of wisdom that we had last week, that the Buddha holds in the realm of the Asuras, the Titans. Um, Yeah, I just thought I'd mention those as the kind of the corollaries, as it were, of these three characters, as it were. Should we do the chatting thing? Should we do the small group thing? Four groups? Three groups? How many of you are there? Or both are there? There's about 19, aren't there? Three sixes? Three sixes and a seven or something. Two sixes and a seven, I guess. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. You can go either way, Terry. Either way. We get the armadillo. I can turn this off now, can't I?
Okay.
Feelings would be one of two types. It would either be craving, that fancied them, or aversion. Well, I had no conscious awareness that this is how I was reacting. I went on a retreat. It was a 7-day retreat, and it was a retreat with guys only. And it was really, you know, you imagine meditating every day and spending time with guys and my own country. This probably opened me up. I just became a lot more aware. And also, I probably give a chance for a lot of kind of mental stuff that's going on to calm down. Came back off that retreat. First, I came to a class here one evening, pretty woman, went up to her, started talking, and I just suddenly realised, it all just dropped, and I suddenly realised how I was reacting. I suddenly became consciously aware that I selected this woman on the grounds of my contact and feeling, my attraction to her, and I was reacting in a particular way, based on my deep unconscious sexual attraction. And from that realization, and you know what I've learned over the years now is just to say that yeah, I need women who I'm physically attracted to, but I can now choose how I react, and I'm put to one side the kind of desire to have sex with them and just get on and develop communication with them and just enjoy friendships with them. I think that's just, you know, you see a process there of, you know, the unconscious contact and feeling, but through meditation and put myself in conditions where I could slow down all my normal habits and getting out of my normal habits, I was actually able to become conscious of, you know, my unconscious habits. And I then was able to make a conscious decision that I would react differently when I became aware of this happening time and time again. And so, you know, the cycle is still there if I get to that point where the feeling occurs. But, you know, I'm now aware that I have a choice, and I catch myself and say, well, I don't want to go down that path. It's actually much more fun to actually treat this person who I'm attracted to exactly the same way as I treat, you know, guys or women I'm not attracted to. And I've made that choice. And that's the conscious bit coming in.
I think there's a huge principle there about what one does with awareness and habits. You know, is that awareness won't make your habits go away. You'll still have the same predilections, as it were. But what you can do is then take them into account in how you behave. Because if you don't take them into account, you know, if you aren't aware of what your patterns are, or if you pretend that's not the case, I've talked about this before with the whole kind of "I'm not angry" thing, haven't I?
then it comes out, it will squeeze its way out somewhere, or it will manifest, well, often that, the way they sometimes talk about it, it will manifest sort of negatively, the dark side of it will come out. You know? Whereas if you hold it within your awareness, then you've got a choice. You know, it doesn't have power over you, in a way. That's the sort of great line of this remember after. That which is outside our awareness controls us. You know? It has power over us. Because we don't know about it, we can't take it into consideration. As soon as something's in your awareness, then you can say, well, okay, this is my predilection in this situation. I can either choose to go with it, or I can choose to do something else. Or I can deliberately make a decision to do the opposite, because I need to work at cultivating the opposite. No. Green buns, no green buns. Have I thought about demons? What you do with demons? Lend us your purva. So what we have here is a vicious wee thing called a demon beggar. Right? A purva. Anybody who's interested in these things, it has a three-sided blade. The great thing about three-sided blades is they don't heal very well. You know? You stab someone with a two-sided blade, it just goes in and comes out. Three-sided blade makes it all messed up. You know? But what you do with a demon dagger is you use it not to stab demons, but you use it to pin them down and maim them. So what you do with a demon is you spot your demon. So you have the demon of craving for cream buns. You know? And what you do with the demon of craving for cream buns is you say, ha-ha! I pin you down. And you name it. I'll give you a better example. Anxiety is a really good example. Really good example. If you don't spot anxiety for what it is, then it really, really builds on itself, because you start sort of, you know, you're a bit twitchy, and sort of if you don't clock it, then you start doing more things, and then you do some more things, and then you're much less likely to do it because you're all a bit busy. But if you can spot the demon of anxiety and pin it down and name it and just sort of go, oh right, I'm anxious, you know? You are the demon of anxiety. What happens is a demon, when it's pinned down and named, releases its energy for you, so it's available for you. So you name the demon. If you're anxious and you're not aware of it, you know, if I'm not angry, you know, unless you pin down your demon and name it, then its energy is all tied up, you know, it's controlling how you operate. Once you pin it down and name it, then it makes its energy available to you. Does that make sense? Does that kind of, it's kind of psychological, but it's also kind of symbolic and mythological, kind of in a way. And I think that's a really valuable tool. Thank you. Handy prop for the evening.
How can you name anxiety?
Well, you recognise it for what it is. Because it's for some of us it's such an all-pervading experience that it's very, very difficult to spot, you know, it's just sort of there so much of the time, influencing how we behave, what we do, whether I do that, whether I do this.
It weakens us because we use us to sleep.
So anxiety weakens us, we become more anxious. I realise that, but it's also kind of ill, that becomes depression, anxious all the time. They can't see that anxiety, otherwise they would feel it down.
Well, I think this comes back to our wheel of life. You know, it's kind of like if we're in a reasonably human state, then just simply spotting that we're in it, you know, that we're sort of behaving in a low level, what you might call neurotic way, you know, so we're behaving that, we're manifesting anxiety, then that would be enough to release the energy of the demon. You know, we just spot it, and it's just kind of like, oh yeah, I'm in a bit of a tears. What I need to do is sit down and have a cup of tea and reassess what, you know, just think about what are my priorities, what have I actually got to get done today. Because a lot of the time it's kind of, you know, we're not even quite sure what it is we're anxious or worried about. If that's gone on for an awful long time, and we've got quite a bad set, then we're going to need some help with that, aren't we? So depending on where you are in the realms, as it were, you might need, you know, if you're really quite ill with that, then you're going to need some amrita. If you're in hell realm, you're going to need some sort of chemical intervention to be able to create a space from which you can start to be creative, yeah? If you're in the Asura Loka, if you're a Titan, then what you need is some clarity about what the actual priorities are, you know, what is really important here.
I don't know why they're anxious.
I think sometimes, yeah, sometimes it's a very long path. You know, there's a guy who lives in my community who's on while antidepressants and tranquilizers. And he's had quite a difficult time over the past few years. And it's going to be a long time before he's able to be able to work creatively with his mind without that chemical help, really. Not least because in some respects chemical help kind of feeds on itself, as it were. It's very difficult to make that break. It can be very, very, yeah, it can be a very long, slow process. But Richard was saying, it's not like we spot the gap once and we're off up the spiral, you know, it's kind of like, yes, thank you, exit ramp, I'm out of here, you know, I'm off the M25. And
I'll still sit by Dan and I'll manage to spot the rest, you know. I'll manage to spot the gap. But when I did, you know, the couple of times go after it, that's the only reason I got it. Yeah, but it's like, I've still got that, you know, I still have to remember sitting down and thinking, well, I'll do that. Before we get to work, we'll do that. But, it's kind of unfortunate. Well, you know, that's a gross example. I look back and I think, the last year that we're bringing was a rough about, you know, surely that, you know, there's at least 10, 15 years that were old time, and it turned out as well, yeah, 40% of that's all problem at this time. But the more, you know, sort of more I look at it, it's okay then, but it still seems a bit gross. But it's no regret with it, I think, because of the direction. I think, you know, maybe I'll open that back to the jacket a bit,
there's a couple of things. One is that basically, yeah, this is a model of addiction. You know, to all intents and purposes, you could say that samsara and addiction are the same thing. Conditionality, psychic models, you know, we're just addicted to particular forms of behaviour. We're just habitual in the same way as with alcohol or heroin or shopping or sex or anything like that. You know, we're just stuck in this loop. You know, we're going to make the same break out of it in the same way as Richard's been able to with alcohol and nicotine. You know. The other thing is just what you were saying about things looking like they're okay from a particular point of view made me think of what are called the vicariatis. So one of the ways in which you can define ignorance, this avidya, is in terms of what's called the vicariatis, which Subhuti translates as the topsy-turvy. It literally means seeing the upside down. So those of you who know there's yoga, vicariatis just means turned upside down. So ignorance is perceiving that which is impermanent as permanent, as enduring, perceiving that which is insubstantial as substantial, having you know, real selfhood, perceiving that which is unsatisfactory as satisfactory, yes, but perceiving kind of day-to-day sort of humdrum existence as being fine, you know. And sometimes there's a fourth one of those habits, which is seeing that which is ashubha as shubha, and shubha means beautiful, yeah? So we see that which is not beautiful, as shubha, so ugly, as beautiful, as pleasant. So I think, so that's, you know, so we see being completely out of it as enjoyable. Yeah? I remember seeing this, I've noticed this with my taste in music, for example. A lot of the things I used to enjoy listening to, I just, most of the time, most of the time, I just don't want to listen to them because they just seem too unpleasant, really. You know, I don't get in the mental states that fit with the Butthole Surfers anymore. As you're familiar with the Butthole Surfers, you'll be quite grateful for that. But on the whole, sometimes I go and visit it just for a laugh, as it were. But, you know, that sort of very coarse, unpleasant music, particularly kind of latter-day time, that sort of stuff just seems so unpleasant a mental state to be in, that I can't imagine why anybody would want to go there, you know. perceive something as beautiful from the point of view of our coarseness of mind, as it were, from the coarseness of our consciousness, something seems quite pleasant on that same level. The more refined your consciousness is, the less something coarse, you know, the more ugly something relatively coarse seems.
For example, if you send that
It depends whether you're changed. Well, I suppose the thing is, it depends whether you've got a vertical change or a horizontal change, doesn't it? Some things just change through fashion, as it were. You know, our tastes change over time. So I wouldn't wear the same clothes that I was wearing 15 years ago, or the same spectacles that I was wearing 15 years ago. In another 5 years' time, I'll be retro chic, you know, and I'll be wearing them again. You know. But so that's a change on a horizontal level. You could say, you know, we stop listening to a particular type of music because it's unfashionable or it's just kind of, you know, out of date or something. But there's actually a shift in level of consciousness that can take place as well. So that we start to listen to different things or enjoy different sorts of books or different sorts of art, different sorts of movies, different sorts of kind of pastimes. Because we've worked on ourselves and become more subtle beings, so we're less coarse beings. It's not that, the two are absolutely separate, as it were, but there are those two different processes going on. Does help to calm them. I get this a lot with my own mum. Mum's 80. She's been doing the anxiety bath and very effectively for 80 years. She's really, really good at it. She's got it down to an art. My mum can manifest anxiety about the most surreal things that you couldn't possibly conceive of people being anxious about. I think I said this before. And really, there's nothing much I can do about that other than be kind and support her and encourage her. Particularly, I suppose if you take that at the more sort of encourage, you know, to give her courage. It's in Buddhism, there's we look at the perfections, the sort of qualities that one develops. And the first of these is the generosity. And one of the greatest gifts you can give to people is the gift of fearlessness. So your encouragement in that kind of, take it back to the meaning of the word, to give courage. That's a very good thing to do to people, you know, to bless and encourage and support people. It's a very, very useful thing you can do. And that's perhaps the best we can do, sometimes.
It's very violent, if you love and get some of the aspects, you don't go like that, just actually don't know who you are. So that's really, really selfless love. It's fine.
I think that's a very, very difficult question to answer. And I think perhaps over the last 20 years we've been a bit simplistic about it in the movement. I think we have perhaps been a bit too simplistic in our practice the Dharma, teach the Dharma. That's the way off the wheel, as it were. You know, that's what really solves suffering. And that's true, and it's not quite enough. as well, you know. And last night we had a chap called Africa, who's just had a book published which is about a Buddhist perspective on environmental activism. And it was very interesting hearing him talk about it, particularly because it's my background, you know, I work in conservation, and I've been actually quite sort of reactive to that whole area for the past 7 or 8 years. And I'm realising I need to have a sort of more responsible attitude to it. I went on, I've talked to a few people about this already, I went on the anti-war march on Saturday. And that's the first march I've ever been on, actually. Well, I might have a little bit better. And I've had quite an aversion to that sort of thing. And partly just because I'm a bit of an individualist and I don't really like being involved in groups of anything, really. But I thought it was a really, really positive thing to do, actually, and it did make me feel that I'd like to need to be a bit more politically active. I need to communicate the implications of my value in terms of social activity and things like that. But I would personally, I would prioritise communicating the Dharma, because I think that's, I think there are an awful lot of people out there who are capable of being a good social worker. I think there are relatively few of us who can communicate the Dharma well. And given that I think I can do it reasonably well, that's my priority for the moment. But I have to be open to that changing. I have a friend who, one of my main teachers actually, who was the chairman of the Buddhist Centre in Bristol and went off to set up his own business, and he was talking quite a lot about, you know, taking the Dharma into the business world and things like that. And he's recently decided he doesn't want to do that, and he's actually getting quite enthusiastic about selling Clean Easy products. Clean Easy, you know, so he goes around to little old ladies, gives them a Clean Easy catalogue, you know, and they buy dust pans and brushes and all that sort of stuff. And a mutual friend of ours sent me an email yesterday saying it's become clearer to him that actually what actually I was really trying to do is to make some money, really. And that the kind of communicating the Dharma to the business world in a different language was a bit of icing on the cake of that, in a way. The ideal was actually to go out and make a lot of money. And but he did sort of say, you know, and maybe, you know, selling Clean Easy stuff will bring in some money with a lot less effort, but it doesn't seem to me to be very high on my list of priorities for what order members can contribute to the world. I think we're starting to get a bit more politically responsible. I think this whole sort of PS movement, which is the environmental awareness group, I think they're very good. I mean, those of you, it's worth looking at one of their carbon emission questionnaires from them, so kind of look at that. I think it's useful stuff. I think each of us has to make a call on that. Yeah. Live each day as though it's your last, but practice as though you have 1,000 years. And there is a need for us to seize the day. You know, we need to be getting on with it. But at the same time, we need to avoid being anxious about that in a way. You know, we need to have a kind of bit of a sort of sense of spaciousness and beauty about it as well. And that balance, that tension, is something we have to work with all the time. Julie's got a bag of soy. It's cooking about 10 o'clock. Oh. Just go and turn.
Seize
the afternoon. Boom. That's a better joke than many of the others we've got this evening, isn't it? Okay, shall we do the 2 minutes sitting quietly?
Quite a good thing to do, isn't it?